I'm Mike Vardy, and this is the Productivityist Podcast.
So today, as I wrapped up my interview with today's guest, my conversation with John Acuff, I thought maybe I'll wait till next week to record the introduction and the outro. And then I thought, no, that goes against the spirit of this episode, which is all about finishing. And so I decided to finish what I needed to do for this episode right then and there. I had a great time chatting with John today. I really enjoy his writing and his presentation style. We had actually had great conversations after we turned the microphone off. We just talked about sports and stuff. And of course, there's also the bonus episode that all of the supporters of the podcast get. I'll talk more about that at the tail end of this broadcast. But John's new book, Finish, the gift it's a great gift. It's a great gift to yourself. There's so much about starting things and, the messy middle and all that, but the finish, we really get into that. We talk about fear, perfectionism, a whole slew of things. So I'm just going to let us get right into it here. Here's my conversation with the very funny, very, affable and really, really smart John Acuff here on the Productivityist Podcast. John Acuff has returned to the Productivityist Podcast to finish off where he started. John, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was not entirely a pun that I just did during the intro, because literally his new book, your new book, Finish, Give Yourself the Gift of Done, has just come out as this episode is airing. And I have to say, there are a lot of dog ears in my copy of this book.
Oh, good. Good. That's encouraging.
All the way to the end. All the way to the end. So let's talk about the idea of why this book now, especially since the one before this was Do-Over. So you went Start, Do-Over, Finish. And so I'm wondering why Finish, like, why did you go down this road in this particular way with this book?
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely thematically out of order. But what happened was I wrote a book called Start a couple of years ago that was about getting people to start things they wanted to do. And I thought, that was what mattered most. But in the years that followed, people would grab me at conferences or pull me aside at events and say, hey, no offense, I love Start, but I've never had a problem starting. I start a million things. Starting's the easiest thing in the world. How do I actually finish? What does that take to get something done? And I thought, wow, that's a really good question. And I needed an answer for my own life. And so the way I write books is I find a problem that I think I have and a lot of other people have too. And if you look at statistics, 92% of goals fail. And then if you just even look at garages, like how many people have a treadmill that now is used to dry laundry, or how many people bought P90X and were like, I'm going to get ripped, and then didn't. And so I thought, wow, there's something here. And that kind of launched me into this research where for the first time I actually did real research with a researcher from the University of Memphis. And we studied nearly 900 people for a 6-month period to try to get a sense of what does it take to actually finish a goal.
I want to talk a little bit about the day after perfect, because you talk about that. I mean, I've gone through the book, like I said, and this is in chapter one. One of the things you say is the worst part about kind of the idea of starting goals and never completing them, it actually feels terrible. Why do we spend so much time starting things? And it's funny, as we're recording this, I'm in the midst of a fallen finish. Like I wanted to get this thing done by the end of August as we're recording this, and it's likely not going to be finished, and it's something that should have been finished before, but there have been three other things that I decided to start so why do we have these goals? And the research I know you've done kind of talks about this, that we start all these things and then we never finish them, knowing full well that not finishing something makes us feel terrible.
Well, I mean, part of it is culturally, it's the part of the process we celebrate. You know, my 14-year-old daughter came home from 8th grade the other day and she said, Dad, there's this poster in our class, and the poster says, the finish line doesn't matter. What matters is the courage to start. And so like, that's a fun thing to say, but it's garbage.
Yeah.
Like if you were in the middle of a marathon and I said, Mike, remember the finish line doesn't matter. You had courage. You're so brave. Like your bravery is enough. Like that would be terrible advice. So I think culturally we teach it. I think that we like to celebrate it. And then we like to leave when people have to do the hard work of the middle and the finish. And so I think that culturally it's that way. The other thing is you have to know that starting will always be sexier, more fun, and easier than finishing. So you just mentioned, okay, I had this thing and then these other three things popped up. Nothing encourages new ideas to pop into existence like trying to finish an old one. Mm. And everyone writing a book right now, like every one of your listeners, which statistically, according to the New York Times, is 81 to 90% of Americans say they want to write a book. Less than 1% do. The reason why is because they go, okay, like right as I'm about to finish, 100 new ideas come up and you go, I got to put them in the book. And you keep going and going and going and going. And so I think that's part of the epidemic. And the last thing I'd say is I often tell people we live in an age of bottomless opportunities and endless distractions. No one, you know, you can argue tech is good or bad or which parts are good or bad. No one on the planet who's intelligent would say we've become less distracted as a culture. Like, are you kidding me? Like, we have more distractions, you know, and notifications and dings and, you know. So part of it is that we just live in a distracted culture, probably the most distracted, you know, in history.
How do you untether yourself from that kind of stuff? Because it's funny. I was talking to I was actually talking to Sean McCabe about clarity and margin and focus. And the idea of those distractions, they crop up, they sneak in. How do you mitigate those? Because they are the things, they are one of the things, you've got a lot of things that get in the way of finishing, but they are one of the things that get in the way of finishing. How do you mitigate those?
Yeah, I think mitigate's a good word. I mean, for me, it's about reducing them, not eliminating them. Mm-hmm. Like I'll always need to use email, like not using email is a dumb goal. I'll always like, somebody the other day told me like, oh, you seem distracted by Twitter. Maybe you should stop. And I wanted to say, you've never sold a book in your life. Like, what do you think? Maybe I should stop. Like, that's not how this works. And so I think you find what works for you. So, you know, in the book, one of the things I put, I had four or five friends in my mastermind go, I'm so productive on a plane. I'm so productive on a plane. And most people, they stop right there. They don't go, huh, I wonder why that is. And huh, I wonder if I could recreate some of those things on land. And when you stop and go, why is that? You realize, well, we have a certain amount of time to work. I can only bring certain projects. Nobody interrupts me. I don't have a Wi-Fi signal on most flights. And so a smart person then goes in and goes, okay, I'm going to do the same thing just in my day, like in my normal day. And so part of it for me is I don't get any notifications other than text messages. Like I don't have any social media notifications. I had to physically hide my email app, like from the bottom bar of my phone deep into my phone. I didn't have an email app on my phone for like 10 days, but I realized I had a hard time subtracting. Like I couldn't divorce that from the calendar. And that was an issue. Mm. Like I needed the calendar. And so you just, you know, when I go to write, I take a couple things and go specifically. I don't combine efforts. Like when I'm writing, I'm writing. When I'm editing, I'm editing. Those are two very different actions. And so I think it's, you know, and I don't sleep with my phone. Like I leave my phone in the kitchen. Like, because I mean, think about it. What does Netflix give you? Like 5 seconds now before they start a new one? So it's like a 5 second countdown to you not having a life?
Yeah, it's almost, I run into the problem. I'm like, no, stop. Like whereas before it was a deliberate choice to continue. Now you have to, I mean, if you're not paying attention, all of a sudden it starts. You're like, no, but I don't want to watch another episode of The Defenders right now. I don't.
Yeah. And so I just think, you know, you have to be deliberate about it. I would say another thing for me, like, when I run, I was listening to too many audiobooks. Like it was too much. So now I've started to cycle more. And I don't listen to stuff while I'm cycling because it's dangerous. Mm. And so it's a forced quiet time. I'd love to say I had the discipline to do all these things, but a lot of times I have to figure out, okay, here's a way around it. Here's how I be deliberate. Here's what's smart. So I don't know. And you have to know it's going to change. They're going to keep popping up. New things are going to come into your life that you go, oh, I didn't even know that was a thing. Okay, now I have to figure this out. So I think of it as a game.
Yeah, you get a new device and you install it, and all of a sudden all the defaults that you turned off are back on, and you have to...
Or a new app.
Yeah.
Or you felt like, I'm tracking calories right now because I'm curious, and it's hard not to just like go in and be look up foods, or like there's a lot of distractions that come with that.
I want to talk about the types of motivation that you talk about in the book. You talk about the fear motivation and fun motivation. And one of the things that I actually... I was reading the book, and I got to the part where you talk about candles and the candle that you use. And my daughter and I went shopping, and there was actually, and I don't know if you know this, but there are actual candles that I found some candles. One is the smell is warm, old fashioned pipe. So I picked up that because I like the smell of a pipe. I don't like what the other after effects of a pipe would be, but I love it. Reminds me of like a study. And so that idea of that you brought to the book, can you talk a little bit about that? Because you know why I picked up that candle. Obviously, there's that I want to have that avatar that it brings, or that kind of trigger that it offers. But you have the candle. Can you tell a little bit about what that candle means to you and how you use it?
Yeah, it's just marketing. I mean, it's a triggering effect. Like when you walk into a W hotel, the smell, the texture, the lights, they're using every sense to move you in a certain direction. I mean, at busy times of the day, Chipotle plays faster music to get you to eat faster and leave. So why wouldn't I use those same tricks on myself?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the tricks for this is I'm only going to light this candle when I'm writing a book. And so it's like an extra reward for sitting down to write the book. Like, is it a big deal? No, of course not. But is it something I look forward to? Yes. I mean, my favorite one of those kind of games, so to speak, is in the book. A guy I know, his wife has a huge like to-do list for him, like change a light bulb, like fix this door. And so he has a jacuzzi. It's his favorite thing. He gets in a jacuzzi. And so he said to himself, before I get in the jacuzzi, I need to do like a 15-minute chore. And now he says, like, if I don't do one, I don't feel good in the jacuzzi. Like, he's so Pavloved himself that he's like, this is the thing. Like, he's related them so closely. So I just think you figure out what works for you in that sense, and then you make it a game.
The secret rules that you talk about in this book are also pretty pretty compelling. I mean, you bring up stories of you know, actors who chose certain film roles and how, why they went down this road, and all of a sudden, oh, it opened doors for them to do things that they really wanted to do. Can you talk about how secret rules can impact your way to finish, and maybe a little bit about maybe one of your secret rules that you kind of smoked out yourself?
Yeah. So I would tell you honestly that this chapter is my favorite chapter of any book I've written. I just think it's such a helpful idea. And I think it's going to really encourage a lot of people. So the chapter starts with this really interesting story that I heard, about cuckoo birds. So the cuckoo bird is what's known as a parasitic brood. So what that means is when it's going to have a baby, it doesn't build its own nest. It finds another bird who already has had eggs in the nest and puts its egg alongside them, and then it leaves. And the cuckoo has a faster incubation cycle, so it hatches first, and the first thing it does is kill all the other birds. Now, the mother bird, not recognizing this different species, usually ends up dying from having to overfeed this huge, massive bird, because it'll be like a finch with a gigantic cuckoo. And so I relate that to the lies that we've just come to believe over the years, that if we really looked at them, we'd go, wait a second, this isn't my bird. Like, this isn't the truth. Like, what are you doing in this nest? And so I relate, you know, I'll give one example of a friend and then I'll share one of mine. So my friend, super powerful executive for Viacom, gets a job traveling from New York to LA, decides, okay, I got to get new luggage, like hip new luggage. So he gets new luggage. It's painful. It's the shoulder strap digs in. It's great looking, but it's like a lot of things that sacrifice function for form. And so he's at the airport one night, and he sees this woman, you know, business dressed woman walking through the airport, and she looks calm and peaceful, and she's wheeling a bag. And he had to stop and say to himself, wait, wait, wait. When did I start to believe that wheels don't count? And that was one of his rules. And so that's what I mean. A lot of times when you work with people, whether they're your employees, a friend, and you go, they're so close to getting it right, why do they always sabotage? It's often because they have a secret rule they believe. You know, money is bad is a secret rule that a lot of people believe. I had a friend at dinner tell me, ah, that guy, that CEO makes $20 million a year. How do you think he sleeps at night? And I wanted to say, like, probably on down Hungarian down pillows, like very comfortably. And his secret rule was a certain amount of money is evil. And so I would say one of my secret rules, I guess one of my secret rules would be that people don't want to be bothered. Like, friends don't want to be bothered. And when you ask them for help, it bothers them. And the truth is, because you always have to find the truth is friends love helping friends. Like, when I, you know, for the launch of this book, I just had to be super vulnerable. Like, I don't like asking friends with platforms to help. I don't like, you know, but for this book, because I think it's the best book I've ever written, I wanted it to sell. And in order for that to happen, I had to be brave enough to say, it's not true that my friends don't want to help. In fact, they're usually excited when I ask them for help. So I'm going to do that. And so I had to work on that secret rule. And a lot of times, high performing people, like my favorite one in the book, like, and she says it's crazy. She knows it's crazy. I'm not saying anything she wouldn't say. This woman said, hey, one of my secret rules is that to be in shape and to be fit is slutty, and to be out of shape is more humble. And she said, I know that's crazy, but that's what I tell myself. And I thought, like, a lot of times you've inherited them from parents. Like, a mom, my friend's mom, I have a friend really successful, multimillionaire. His mom used to say, anybody who has that much money is probably doing something illegally. And he finally had to say to her one day, like, mom, you like, you raised me, you know, that's not how I live life. I make a lot of money. That stop saying that. That's just not true. And so, yeah, that concept to me, I think, could be a whole book.
Let's talk about the idea of data now, because I've become more fascinated with it as well as of late. I'm very much I'm a very qualitative person. And having read your books before, you know, I there's a qualitative nature to your book, to all of your writing that I found. And when you start to do 30 days of hustle, you're now applying quantitative data to it. And all of a sudden you're starting to do research, and data is something you dive into in this book. What have you always been a bit of a data person, just kind of quietly behind the scenes analyzing things and then searching for like the qualitative relationship to that data?
No, dude. No, it's so unnatural to me.
Yeah.
It's so, like, I'm 41 now, so I'm like, wait a second. No, I just decided I want things to be a lot easier. I want to win more.
Right.
And so the phrase I say in the book is data kills denial, which prevents disaster.
Mm.
And so, like, here's a stupid data example. So for the last couple of weeks, a friend of mine had this app they like, where it's like a calorie app. And I was like, I'm curious about that, because I've always been the guy in an emotional sense who says things like, what do I need to, do to get in shape? I'll just exercise really, really hard. And people would tell me, well, you know, like, health, like, eating is like 90% of it. And I'd be like, well, I'll just do even more. Like, and I'm not going to even look at that. I'm not going to crack the data. So finally I was like, this is exhausting.
Damn.
So I started keeping track of calories. And, like, here's an example of data. I'm at a steak restaurant and I say, hey, I'd like that horseradish with the steak. And they go, do you want raw horseradish or the cream? And I go, give me both. And while they're bringing them, I look up the calories. The cream is 220 calories. The raw horseradish is 7. And that was what I wanted anyway. Like, I wasn't saying I like cream on steak. I was saying I like horseradish and the flavor. And so knowing that data gave me exactly what I need to make a decision. And so that's what I tell people. And it tells the truth. You know, I had an example in the book, and you've done this before. If you've ever launched something or sold something online, like, my daughter, she's 14. Just the other day, she said, Dad, because she started a new Instagram photo account, and she has a personal account. So she said, Dad, I posted it on my story of my personal one, and 100 people looked at it, and only one person signed up for my photo one. And I said, welcome to social media. And that was easy for me to say, because I had the data that said, yeah, like, if you're new to something, you think, oh, you share it with 100 people, you get like 40% response. And you're like, no, that is not. And so I just think it helps you make so many better decisions.
Okay. So since I'm in the same boat, like, I mean, at 43, I've spent time obviously with productivity, analyzing data to a certain degree, but I'm not sort of into that quantitative self to the same degree that a lot of other people can go to. Where do you have a kind of a, again, a rule surrounding that, that you maybe you're like saying, hey, you know what, data is going to help me make decisions, but at the end of the day, like I have to have a measured balance between the two, or I have to have some kind of harmony? Or are you at the point now where the data, like you say in the book, like, and you just said data eliminates, like it can ward off denial because it just tells you the truth. Where are you at with that?
Yeah, I think it's a balance. I mean, I think on the one hand, like the idea of me getting too data focused is hilarious, you know, because like I'm so far away from that naturally. But on the other hand, I would argue one of the reasons a lot of goal setting books don't work is that they're written as if you're a robot. Mm-hmm. They go, here's all the logical reasons you should do this thing. And then like, you're not going to do that thing. And so I'd much rather you as an emotional human go, yeah, I know. Like my favorite example of this. So I worked for Dave Ramsey and he has this principle, the debt snowball. And so Dave says, hey, if you've got five debts, mathematically, you would think I got to pay off the one with the highest interest rate. He said, but psychologically, it's better to pay off the one with the lowest amount you owe, get the win, and then roll it into the next one. And so everybody was like, that's dumb, Dave. Like scientists were always telling him, like, that's the wrong way. And then eventually Time Magazine did a study and said, hey, Dave's right. Like psychologically, that's what works the best. And so I think it's a marriage. I think it's a marriage between going, okay, there is logic and I want to make a great data decision. But there's also that emotional part of you going, hey, I know that's right, but it's not worth it. Like, for instance, for the first 2 weeks when I was doing this calorie counting, I was like, ah, I'll just drink black coffee. Like, I don't want to waste the 40 calories on cream and sugar. But then like 2 weeks in, I was like, that's stupid. Like, I'll do 100 squats to make that up. Like, that matters to me. Mm-hmm. I don't like drinking black coffee like some sort of caveman. Like, that's like, I emotionally, I like a little bit of cream and sugar. Like, I'm not going crazy. But I think you have to marry it because we are emotional. We do have feelings, but I still think you need data to say like, oh, wait a second. Like the reason a lot of plans fail is because people don't want to put data. They want to plan with miracles, right? Where it's like, and then this happens and it's a miracle. And then Ellen finds my book at her doctor and it's a miracle. And you go like, I don't like plans that depend on miracles, especially multiple miracles.
I was at VidCon this year and there was a lot of, which by the way, if you've never been to it, it's basically just Fan Expo for YouTube. I thought there might be a little bit more for me to learn at it. All I learned is that YouTube's really popular. Go figure.
Yeah. And people like photos of YouTube people.
But a lot of the panels, there were some that were, there was like a couple that were really, really good. Very, you know, how to, here's how you should do things. But there were a lot of them were, hey, here's how I hit the big time, or here's how things happen. I created a video, it went viral, and now I'm here. I'm like, well, that's not data. That's
super helpful.
that does not help me at all. So yeah, it's. But what I want to get to now is the idea of when you want to not only start something, but when you are at the point of finishing, because this is where I can tell you, honestly, this is where I'm at right now with a lot of things. A book proposal that I'm working on, for example. You know, I'm sitting there rewriting it and working on it and mapping it out. And all of a sudden, despite my ardent love and my own wearing of the Green Lantern ring, fear, it rears its ugly head in many, many forms. Why, first off, what are your thoughts on fear? I know you talk a lot about it in the book, but you don't just talk about fear in its most basic form. You talk about the forms that it can take on.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of them, you know, that the book talks about a lot is the idea of perfectionism. Mm. And the problem is we treat it like a characteristic or a good thing, and it's not. I've been telling authors lately that Amazon has never sold a perfect book. They've sold millions of imperfect finished books. And so I think part of it to fulfill what I think it's going to fulfill. Sometimes it's, I don't have a thing after it. I'll feel really like, well, now what, you know, like that sense of like, And the other thing you have to remember is that when you finish, it's no longer yours and it's no longer private. So if I have a small business idea and I work my heart out on it in my room, until I finish and share it with the world, I don't get criticized. You know, like I could have 10 books I've written under my bed. So the finish, that's why you can't, you know, you can't overestimate the intimidation of the finish line, where you say, okay, people are going to know this, like people are going to judge this. I remember Tim Sanders, great author, said to me, hey, do you want to know what Kurt Vonnegut, the author, said to me? And I was like, oh my gosh, of course. And he said, Kurt Vonnegut said Mark Twain would have killed himself if Amazon reviews existed when he was a writer. And I thought that was really interesting, because he's right. You know, like, he didn't have to deal with that. So I just think it just becomes this buffet of possible pain. And if you overfocus on that versus what will happen when you finish, you miss it. And the other thing is, like, here's the thing nobody likes to talk about, Mike. You don't control the miracle. Like, you send your work out there, and then you really, like, every YouTuber there who is telling people how they, like, went viral, it's garbage. Like, it was a series of things outside of their control. Like, I don't control Kathy Lee Gifford finding my book at her doctor's office and having me on the Today Show. Like, I don't. Like, I know my efforts will sell an X amount of books, but I don't control 250,000. Like, I wish I did, dude. Like, I would sell that. It would be a video course, like, you know, whatever. But I think that's part of it too, is that sense of vulnerability and admitting the part I control is over and here we go.
I want to touch on one more thing before we wrap up. And that's the idea, you dove into the idea of perfectionism, but I want to talk about the idea of those goals. And how goals, we feel like we have to have a lot of them in order to move forward, you know, and we end up kind of sabotaging ourselves because there's a lot of goals that we have and we never fully realize them. You talk about the idea of goals in the book and how some of them, you know, the idea of SMART goals and things like that and where that fits in. Can you touch on that a little bit more? Because I know there's a lot of people, in fact, we're going to see Leo Babata at Jeff Goins' Tribe conference. He's got the no goals that he talks about, right? So where do you sit on goals when it comes to the idea of how they can impact what you finish and how you finish?
Yeah, it's always funny. Like, sometimes when people say no goals, they're using a different word and they're like, have purposes. Oh, okay, fine. That's vernacular. Like, and the idea of having no goal is a goal. Like, that's what's like, yep. We, you know, if you want to do something deliberate, call it a goal, call it a plan, call it a desire, whatever. I think part of what I hope to do with this book is to attack and refute popular goal statements that aren't helpful and actually hurt you. So one of the approaches that's very popular is to say, oh, you've got a financial goal, you need a physical goal, you need a relational goal, you need a spiritual goal. And so what most books do is say there's seven parts of your life, you need a goal for each one. But Mike, if you told me, like, John, I'm going to learn Norwegian, I wouldn't say learn six other languages too. That would be terrible advice. If you were training for a marathon, I wouldn't say train for six other events, like train for an archery tournament. And so I'm a much, and again, it's counterintuitive. And I think, like, some of the rah-rah entrepreneur people aren't going to like me necessarily. But the reality is that, you know, the less you are able to focus on, the more you get to focus on those things. And so, for instance, I think, you know, every goal should start with, what am I going to suck at during this time? So, you know, and that can be a million different things. In the book, I tell the story of my yard was garbage when I had kids under the age of three. It wasn't the time for me to have a good yard. Like, there's some dads out there listening that their golf game should suffer when they have a newborn because they're not playing 6 hours, you know, on the weekend. Like, that's not failure. That's, you know, deliberate kind of putting something down. So that's what I like to do. So I like less goals. I don't like to prioritize them. I think that's the biggest time trap in the world, because you try to prioritize them perfectly and you never will. I like to have a handful of goals going at the time. I like to have some big ones that are far out. Like, I want to ride I got a new bicycle. I want to ride it 10,000 miles and then I'm going to buy a new mountain bike. But I'm not worried about that 10,000 miles because that's 4 years out probably. I'm more like, how many can I get this week? You know, how many can I get this week and move it on?
So, last question. The book is finished. The book is now finished. You're done it. I mean, there's all the marketing and the post-production. How does it feel?
It feels good. I mean, I think, you know, it's intimidating. I think as an author, this landscape is intimidating. I always tell authors, like, if the size of the Lego department at Barnes & Noble doesn't scare you, you're not paying attention. Like, whole shelves of books have been eaten by Harry Potter puzzles. Mm. Like, that's a real thing. Or I'll say, hey, next flight you're on, walk down the aisle and count books versus videos people are watching. And like, dude, it is not encouraging. And so I think the selling of books is challenging, but I'm excited to get it into people's hands. I think it's my most accessible book. I've been really excited. I had a company buy 5,000 copies because every company I talk to says our people could be better at goals. They could be better and we want it to be fun. So I'm excited about it. I'm just excited about learning new things about how to serve an audience.
Well, I will say I've read all of the books you've put up, you know, and we've had you on the show before talk about Do-Over. Sure. And, I say this is your best book to date.
Thanks. That means a lot. I appreciate
it. It's really quite good. And of course, if you've never seen John speak before, I've had the pleasure of seeing John speak at World Domination Summit. Again, a killer speaker. So if you ever get a chance to see John speak in person, entertaining, informative, everything you want in a speaker and everything you want in a podcast guest. John, where can people get the book right now? And is there anything else that you're doing that you want to share that maybe you've started that now people can take a look and see the progress so that when it's finished, they can kind of be part of that process as well?
Yeah, I mean, the book's available anywhere books are sold. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, local bookstores. And then my website is just acuff.me, acuff.me. And then I write an idea once a week for entrepreneurs that you can get. It's just a free idea. It's acuff.me/business. And that one is probably one they could watch me finish something, because eventually I'll turn those into something. And it's been a blast. And I'm really enjoying serving specific audiences with specific content versus like broad audiences with broad content.
Awesome. John, thanks so much for joining me again this week. This podcast episode is now finished.
Thanks.
You see, I told you it was a great episode. We had a great time chatting. We actually talked about some more things over on the bonus episode that every one of the supporters of the podcast guests head over to patreon.com/productivityist, and you can check out how that turned out. And there's a whole bunch of other things that you can get there too. So just head over there if you're not a supporter of the show already, and you can learn all about what happens, what you can get, the benefits of becoming a supporter of the show. Thanks to John Polstra for putting this episode together. Thanks to my team for helping make this show possible. And thanks to John Acuff for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to spending more time with him. As I'm recording this, I'm getting ready to head off to Nashville for Jeff Goins' Tribe Conference. I get to see him and, of course, the guest that was on the previous episode, Sean McCabe. And I'm going to have a great time there. In fact, if you're a supporter of the show, you might get some bonus materials regarding that conference while I'm down in Nashville for my first trip down to Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks again so much for listening. I really appreciate it for your support. Until next time, I am Mike Vardy, the host of the Productivities Podcast and founder of Productivityist, reminding you to stop guessing and start going.